he was trying to teach me how to telemark ski, and we had made it probably 200 meters before we were in a fight. And I was screaming at him, student-centered teaching. And really what I wanted him to just know was the way that I wanted to learn, which obviously he didn't really know, and he was trying his best.
This is Delivering Adventure. Welcome to the podcast that explores what it really takes to share adventure like a pro with your friends, your family, and as a profession. My name is Chris Capio, and I'm coming to you from Whistler, British Columbia.
And I'm Jordy Shepherd, recording from Canmore, Alberta. After a lifetime of working extensively in different parts of the adventure guiding industry, Chris and I have teamed up to launch this podcast. In each episode, you will hear top adventure guides, managers, marketers, and athletes share their best stories, advice, and trade secrets. The goal of this podcast is to share how you can take yourself and others farther from the mountains to the office and beyond. In this episode, we talk with Tracy Fraser. Tracy currently works as a training manager of the Whistler Blackcomb Snow School. She's a level 4 certified ski instructor, which is the highest level you can attain, and instructor examiner with the Canadian Ski Instructors Alliance, at also the highest level you can attain as a examiner. Tracy has also been selected to represent Canada at 2 inter-ski events, which is a kind of a big deal, including the one coming up in 2023 in Finland. When we look at what it takes to deliver adventure, there are 3 main elements. They are perception, capacity, and adversity. If you want someone to achieve an adventure, they have to want to do it in the first place. They need the ability to do it, and the amount of adversity they are exposed to has to be managed so that they are not either overwhelmed or bored. And going back to perception, the experience has to be remembered afterwards as being positive. In this episode, Tracy is going to share with us how we can help people to become better. The better we are at anything, the more enjoyable it becomes, and the more adversity we can handle. In this episode, Tracy is going to share with us some of the secrets of how we can be better at teaching skills. It is worth noting that this is a bit of a sneak preview of what you can expect to hear more of in season 2 of Delivering Adventure, as we spend more time exploring the different skills that go into delivering epic adventures. Now, Chris, you work with Tracy, is that right?
Yes, I do, Jordy. I've been doing some work in the training department at Whistler Blackcomb, so technically she's one of my managers. She's probably one of the first of many people we are going to interview that I work for. Small industry we have. So just to put Tracy's skills into context, Tracy is among the 1% of the top 1% when it comes to being a skilled technical ski instructor in Canada. There are over 20,000 ski instructors in Canada, and only a handful of them are certified to train the highest level of certification. As Jordy mentioned, that level 4. Just achieving that level takes incredible dedication and athleticism. I'm really excited to hear what Tracy has to say. Let's bring her into the studio. Hello, Tracy. How are you?
I'm great, thanks.
Where are you right now?
I am in Squamish, British Columbia. So that's halfway between Whistler and Vancouver, in my house with my new pup.
Can you tell us something about yourself that most people don't know about you?
Yeah, it's funny. With social media, I feel like people know everything about everyone now. But I guess one thing that people may not know is that I have a pretty healthy fear of heights. I just don't like them. I remember being a kid in London and visiting St. Paul's Cathedral with my family and wanting to lie down flat on the floor of the balcony, like just press myself into something solid. And I work on it all the time. And especially, you know, when I'm climbing, it takes a lot of positive self-talk to make myself get to the top of the rope. So that may be something people don't know.
Wow. So you're an instructor, a ski instructor, and you're afraid of heights.
Yeah. So anything that has a bit of exposure, there's some deep breathing going on.
So Tracy, you've made quite a long career out of delivering adventure. Let me start by asking, why did you pick this as your career?
I think there's a couple things that led me to that, if I maybe answer it in that way. One, I've discovered about myself that I really love being outside. So two things. One, you know, I started skiing when I was 3 years old. My mom taught me how to ski, myself and my two brothers. And that's what we did every weekend, is we went skiing. So we spent basically every Saturday, Sunday outside all day. I started racing and loved that. I started instructing, and I found that was a great calling too. So that was part of it. My mom was a teacher as well. So that, I watched her be a really good teacher, and I think I gained a lot of skill from watching how she interacted with people, and I felt I was pretty good at that. So I ended up doing that for a long time. And the other thing is, I worked in the tree planting industry for about 10 years, again, outside. So I'd spend my summers outside, any type, from snow, rain, sun, stream heat, but again, with a group of people. And I went into crew bossing and supervising in those roles too. So again, I was a leader of people in those roles. I can't help myself from being a leader and a teacher. So I love that kind of part of it. And I guess what I really discovered of myself is that I need to be outside in order to be happy. Being outside, leading people, that's my calling.
So what did your path into the adventure industry look like after that?
Yeah, so I did my degree in psychology at Western in Ontario. And the choices coming out of that degree looked kind of lab and clinical-like. And after spending winters on the hill and summers out in a field, I knew that wasn't really an option. So I had friends out west, which, of course, that's what you do when you finish your degree. You don't know what to do with yourself. You go to Whistler. So I traveled out to Whistler and ended up with some pretty great jobs. Two of those were instructing, one in the kids' snow school and one in the adult snow school. Those were separate at the time. And I loved it. And the funny thing was, is that when I was teaching the adults, every day at lunch, we'd go and we'd sit inside together and we'd chat. And I'd ask them what they did, and they'd say, you know, I'm a marketer or I'm a lawyer. And I was like, that's great. That sounds really interesting. And in my mind, honestly, I had mental notes of a no column and a yes column. And the no column just got bigger all the time. And nothing ever went into the yes column. Like, nothing was better than what I was doing. So therefore, I stayed. Yeah. So again, I think it comes back to having those influences of being outside, liking to be a leader of people. That just kind of pushed myself through the snow school as well. So after instructing for a couple of years, I became a supervisor there, and I've spent a lot of years in supervising and management, and then filing into training eventually with Whistler Blackcomb, and I love it.
So can you think of a success that you've had in your career that you're really proud of, that goes beyond, you know, getting certification and that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, I guess it would be along those lines, though. You know, getting the level 4 was one step of it, and it opens a huge amount of doors for you. I chose to keep pursuing that path. So after you get your level 4, you can do your examiner levels. So you can work yourself up from a level 1 examiner, 2, 3, and then 4. And so at this point, I'm a level 4 course conductor and evaluator, which I honestly never knew that that was something that I could do. So yeah, it surpasses my expectations, and I'm pretty proud of that. Again, there's not a lot of women at that stage too, and so I'm happy to be there and try and open doors for a lot of people, you know, achieving their level 4, and it gives me a lot of fulfillment watching people go through that process and helping them achieve their goals. It's really satisfying. And that's, I guess, something to be proud of. And the cool thing about that too is, you know, some of those doors that get opened is that there's an opportunity when you become a course conductor to try out for an InterSki team. And so InterSki is a world skiing congress that happens every 4 years at one point in the world, and instructors from all over the world come together and discuss skiing and show skiing. And a cool thing that I've been able to do is go to Bulgaria in 2019 as part of that congress, and was selected again to go to Finland next year to this congress. So pretty stoked about that.
What makes those events so important in the ski teaching industry?
They are, you know what, they're really fun for one. You know, it helps to ignite your enthusiasm and inspiration for skiing, and seeing that there's people like you all over the world. That I call myself a ski geek. And so these are like ski geeks unite, you know. People are really passionate about delivering that experience and skiing their best, and you know, you need to train a lot to get to that point. You need to really invest yourself. And so this is a group of people from all over the world that are investing just like you are. The really cool thing and the important thing about the event is that you learn from each other, and people are really excited to share what they've been thinking about in skiing and show you what they've been doing in their skiing. So they're important to move us forward as an industry when we all get together and, you know, think about what other people are thinking about.
Now, Tracy, one of the things that you've been able to do in your career was to go over to China and to work with the people over there to grow their ski industry. Can I ask, what did you learn when you were over there? Is the Chinese ski industry similar to what we see in North America or Europe, or is it different?
It's, you know what, going to China is really cool because we're watching something start over there. And there hasn't been, you know, there's been a lot of influence there, I'd say, over the last 10 years. So it's really growing and being a bit of a sponge from a lot of different countries that are going there. So you have influence from Japan, Hong Kong, New Zealand has a big presence there, and Canada as well. And we've been doing a lot of course conductor training over there too. But first going over there, like, man, was it ever a cool experience? Because there's that sense of wonder and awe. People are like, what is this thing? What is this sport? Like, what do we do here? Okay, we have this hill, we have some snow, and let's try it out. And so the enthusiasm and the eagerness of everyone is amazing. You know, you've got grandma out there with her jeans and her long puffy coat, and at that time masks, because the pollution was so bad at some of the resorts around Beijing that you're wearing your mask as well as, you know, your jeans and your coat, and you've got your ski boots on and your skis and you're trying it out. And this is like, it's everyone, it's the whole family that is trying this new sport, which is really cool. Being an instructor there, like, you were a VIP. Like, I was dining with the heads of resorts, and like, I'd be whispering to friends, I'm like, we're just ski instructors. Like, don't they know? Like, because, you know, in Canada, it's not looked upon the same way. You know, your ski instructors, people are like, oh, you ski instruct for a living? Like, it's almost looked down upon. Whereas in China, you're like, you're a superstar. Like, you're amazing. I had posters made of me and would do clinics where I'd have 50 people show up to just stand and absorb whatever they could, even though they may not understand English, we'd have translators, but just to figure out what this new sport was all about. And it was amazing. One thing that was really funny is that taking a lesson wasn't necessarily culture yet. So it was just a try and survive culture. So people would take the lift up to the top of whatever hill was there, stand at the top, watch people go down, and then honestly, like, fling themselves down the hill one after another in total mayhem, like crashing all over the place. And then the next person would go, like, same thing, like trying to do better than the person before them. So one, you had to have eyes in all sides of your head and make sure you're out of the way. But again, that energy and enthusiasm to try something new, it'd be cool to see that here as well.
I've had some experience teaching people from mainland China, yeah. And it's always a lot of fun. The cultural differences make it a lot of fun for sure. I end up with a lot of great stories. And to your point, I was actually skiing with a guy from Beijing who is a doctor, and he was doing an internship in Vancouver for a month, and he came up to Whistler. On day three in the morning, I asked him, I said, well, look, you know, you're here in the resort on your own, like, what have you been doing at night? And he said, well, I've been watching these ski videos on YouTube. And I said, oh, really? And he said, yeah, I've been watching this guy named Josh Foster.
They love Josh Foster.
You know, I love that guy. It just so happened that I had seen Josh that morning. He was in Whistler doing an instructor's clinic. And I had actually skied with and worked with Josh at Sunshine Village a whole bunch of years before that. And so I said, well, look, Albert, I actually know where Josh is going to be. And he said, well, I would love to meet him. And I was so shocked. So I said, okay, well, we'll go up. I know where we're going to find him for lunch. And sure enough, Josh was there. And I went up to Josh. I said, you know, my student really wants to meet you. And Josh was like, he was shocked because he had exactly the same feeling you did. He's like, look, I'm just a ski instructor. And so we went over and I introduced him. And then Albert, my guest, actually had Josh sign his jacket with a Sharpie.
sign his helmet.
He like wrote on his jacket, and Josh is looking at me, and he's like, he's got the same feeling that I do. He's like, really? I'm going to like destroy your jacket. This is a really nice jacket. And then they did photos and things like that. And then at the end of the day, Albert had me sign his jacket too. It was so funny, but the value that Chinese skiers have of, you know, the role models being in, you know, instructors, and I guess to an extent they see them as coaches, teachers, athletes is very different.
Yeah. And I think that comes from Japanese culture as well. When you're, you know, in Japan, there's the technical championships, which are huge. Like they are like superstars and celebrities. I was talking to a friend recently who told me he went over to a demo team competition over there and, you know, had people changing his outfits and making outfits for him. So he would wear three different outfits a day, changing gear, poles. You know, you are a celebrity there. And that influence, I think, has come into China too, so that ski instructors are celebrities. So it's pretty fun when you go over there. You have a really good time with people. And I love that it was Josh that he knew, because it's awesome. Since then, Josh has been over there helping do a lot of courses. And so, yeah, he's signing helmets all over China. It's great.
The irony, the follow-up to that, Tracy, is that I spoke to Josh a year later, and he said to me, he said, you'll never guess who I ran into. I was in China at the end of the season, and I guess he was in Beijing, and he was just north of Beijing. He's one of the resorts, and he looked over, and on the chairlift was Albert. And you're thinking, like, what a small world.
So awesome. That would be common, actually. A lot of people will come over, and that was part of the reason why we went to China, was to try to create a bit of a relationship between Whistler and some of the resorts around Beijing, because we had people flying in every week to come to Canada as well. So yeah, if you want to get famous too, make some YouTube videos of yourself skiing and you will be very famous in China.
There's I find overseas there's connectivity in the ski world that you just don't really expect. I met a fellow in Japan when I was heli ski guiding there a number of years ago, and it was at a ski resort, and he was dressed up kind of funky, and everybody knew him when he walked into the cafeteria there, but I didn't. And apparently he's made a career of skiing backwards his entire career. He's never skied forwards. He doesn't ski forwards. He skis backwards. But he's been doing it for decades. And apparently he's traveled all around the world, and he has quite a following just from skiing backwards.
There you go. You know, there's something out there for everyone. It's awesome.
So Tracy, you've made a career out of teaching people how to become better coaches and instructors. How many years have you been doing that now?
Oh man. I don't know. I guess I started when I was a teenager. And so we would do that every weekend. I would teach one day and I would race the other day, and took a bit of hiatus during university, and then ended up doing it after university. Honestly, I started, it was a few different stops and starts. At the end of university, I didn't know what to do with myself. I had come out west to visit that friend, gone back to Ontario, didn't know what to do. So called up a couple resorts around my hometown and ended up working there for a season at two different resorts. And then came back out west again and ended up with two jobs here. Again, not looking for them. I was going to be a volunteer on the mountain. And they looked at my resume and knew that I was certified. So they asked me to become part of the snow school instead. So yeah, that's, you know, it's been going on now. I'm almost 50. So yeah, I've had a few years under my belt.
Awesome. That's great. Nice, healthy, long career. And what are some tips that you can pass on to our listeners to become a better guide, coach, or instructor?
I think, you know, being a really good coach is someone who knows how to watch people and listen to people really carefully. There's two parts of that. Like, one, you have to be able to watch someone and see what their strengths are, because you want them to be able to use their strengths and build on the strengths that they have. And the other part is to look for weaknesses. You know, what are the components that they need to work on if you're breaking it down to just different skill sets, what is the skill you need to work on with them so that you can strengthen that part so they can put their strengths and weaknesses together, work together, and then, you know, come out with a better result.
So tangible things and kind of individual things. If you throw too much at people, whether it's a coach or instructor or somebody who is being coached or instructed, it just confuses the whole process, right? So I find it's best to try 100%. One thing at a time.
100%. Yeah. I think that's the biggest factor that leads into frustration is when you've moved on too quickly. You know, people really need to be given something new, feel that challenge, work through that challenge so that they're accomplishing something, and then just spend time in that zone. People really do get frustrated if they're feeling some success and you add then too much onto it, and then they lose that feeling of success. That's usually when frustration comes along. And yeah, I've seen a lot of, well, and I've experienced that too as a coach, where I've added too much and then lost everything great that we were just doing. Another part of that is time of day, you know, really paying attention to when you're adding stuff, when their energy is high. If you're trying to, a lot of times what we'll do, our morning schedule is we'll get out there and get activated in the morning, warm up really well, and then, you know, start seeing what we can do, breaking something down, working on that component for a while, putting it back in. And we usually end our day by around 1:30 or so. You know, if you take a break, sit inside for 45 minutes, go back outside, and then try to ramp back up to where you were, it takes a while again. You can't expect those results to come right back. So expecting that, which is one, and again, not then adding a bunch of new stuff on. Just let it sit. Let people really try to consolidate what they've just learned and go with that for a little while. They'll be on a way better step or building block and then come back and add something new maybe the next day.
Awesome. That's some great set of tips there. In terms of being a coach, what are some of the good characteristics of being a good coach? And I suspect your psychology training might help you while you're coaching and instructing as well.
That's funny. My psychology part was actually more perception, you know, like brain and ears and eyes and that kind of stuff. So not that great. But in psychology, yeah, I think the biggest part is that mental game as a coach, right? So again, strengths and weaknesses, being able to read your people really well and treat people like individuals and approach them with what they need and what their goals are. I think a lot of the times we put our goals onto people and we may, again, move them towards something where it's not really where they were wanting to go. So really listening, you know, what is it that they want? What are the goals that they're looking for? What is their motivation? You know, being able to tap into how they are motivated is really important, not how you are motivated. I think sometimes when a connection gets broken, when someone tries to motivate them in the way that they feel motivation, you know, for example, there may be someone that's, a coach that was motivated by being challenged. And for some people, they rise to the challenge. They like being challenged and they'll say, I'll prove you wrong, you know. And there's other people that they just need positive reinforcement. They need small bits. They need to be fed a lot of just positivity for them to keep moving forward. So really being able to treat each person like an individual and feed to what they need is really important.
Yeah, and sometimes it's not bad to throw people right into it. They just want to kind of immerse themselves in that experience and see what they don't know and give them a chance to maybe fail a little bit. And then you reel them back into, okay, well, let's work on that. I recall going to Depot Division in Regina in Saskatchewan as a park warden. And, you know, we all had driver's licenses and we knew how to drive. I've been doing that for a long time. And they gave us the keys to a police car on the track. And they said, they didn't do any instruction at all initially. And they said, go drive a few laps. And we were out in the rhubarb all over the place and yeah, burning out tires and not making corners and hitting certain cones that they called grandma there. It's like, you just hit grandma again, kind of trying to weave through the cones. And then they taught us how to drive. But it really gave us that perspective of, okay, I don't really know what I'm doing here, but I had to show myself that failure first.
Yeah, that is one good approach. That's how I learned how to drive standard. with a huge truck out tree planting in the middle of a field. And they said, well, go ahead, you got to go move the truck. And I think, you know, if you're given the leeway to fail and there isn't personal consequence at stake, that's a great way to learn something when you know the outcome is fun and it really doesn't matter either way. And I think when someone feels that the consequence may be personal, you may have to take a different approach.
Yeah, or if there's danger, obviously.
Yeah.
In order to improve, we often need to change something in ourselves, and we can't change by maintaining the status quo. So there's this bit of a problem there. So how do you think we can convince someone that they should want to change what they're doing if they like what they're doing, but they don't want to change anything?
Yeah, I think that's a hard one because I think it's really hard to convince someone to change. So I guess my perspective or approach with people like that is to present the facts if I can, and a lot of times step back and let them come to the answer. You know, for example, there's sometimes if I'm having a hard time getting through to people, we'll sometimes do a mock evaluation because you've got hard facts. So we'll set up some scenarios where you get marked by a group of people and people receive those marks and it gives them exactly where they're standing, you know, in their skiing on that day. Those results can crush people, which they usually come back from, but it can really motivate people too. But it gives them a really good black and white perspective of where they are. And then they can choose, right? It's really hard. I have learned over the last few years that I can't convince someone to want something. I need them to let them sit with, you know, what is their goal? And if they decide that that is their goal, that I'm there. I'm 100% and I will commit to you, but you got to commit to it first. So a lot of times it's having those discussions with people. It may just be sitting down and saying like, what is it that you want? I can't make you want this. So once they figure it out and they come back to me, then I'm in.
I was at a ski hill with a park warden a bunch of years ago. And we're working on ski skills because we did a lot of backcountry skiing and we were doing rescues and traveling in the backcountry. But often that's not the best way to learn how to ski, especially when you walk up and get a very little bit of down at the end of the day, or maybe a couple short laps.
Yeah.
And so we would spend time at the ski resorts, and I'm not a ski instructor myself, but I've ski raced. And so I have a lot of bad habits probably. And I've been guiding for years. and so I went out with this fellow to the ski hill, and as we ski, you know, we just started skiing down off the lift, and he was holding his elbows way out to the side, like pointing them straight sideways, like he's doing the chicken dance. And I thought that was kind of odd. And so I didn't want to deflate him or anything. You know, wasn't skiing super poorly, but he was in the learning phase. But at one point I did say, so what's with the arms out thing? He's like, oh, well, I was out with another park warden, who was a guide and rescue specialist, a little while before. And they said, hold, you know, 'cause I guess his arms were in too tight. And so they said, you know, hold your elbows out more. So he was overcompensating, right? The pendulum had swung and they're just sticking way out there. And so, but he said, I don't really feel like I'm too far out there. And so I shot a little bit of video, you know, just a 30 second clip of him skiing down and showed it to him. He's like, I look like I'm doing the chicken dance out there. What? And it was just, you know, I think that visualization thing, which is so easy for us to do, right? With the video capability we all have in our phones, in our pockets nowadays. And that just speaks volumes, right? Because people have this self-perception of what they look like and what they're doing and how it feels. And then if you show them visually, right there, it's like, I think I might need to change that.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, the skiing should be, we're really moving right now into a phase of function over form. You know, does the movement serve you or does it not serve you? If it serves you and it's working well for you and you're getting the desired action, okay, go ahead and do it. But, you know, and if it looks crazy, okay, it doesn't really matter in the end. But again, a certain movement can actually throw you off and not allow you to perform. So usually if I can provide some sort of perspective that this movement's going to actually help you achieve X or Y, that's usually when then they can hang on, you know, grasp onto something saying, oh, that's why I want to change that. Okay, I see the result of that. And that usually takes them really far in that way. But yeah, it's really interesting. The other thing too that I've really thought about a lot this year is, in order to change someone's skiing, you have to change their understanding. So a lot of times we'll be holding on to something that someone told us, like we understood skiing to be in a certain way. But if we change the understanding of like, no, you don't need to do this, it's this, or, oh, when that person said that, they probably meant this, not this, the light bulb goes on and that's when they change. So a lot of times the verbal part of skiing, you know, of discussing skiing is really important, you know, besides the showing. Showing is important, but there's two sides of it. Showing and telling are both really important.
Why should we want to be better at anything?
I think that's a great question. And I guess my answer would be that who doesn't feel great when they're getting better at something? You know, it's the best feeling of the world, that feeling of success or fulfillment or growth. I love that. I honestly have built my whole life doing exactly that, improving myself. I'm always looking on ways to improve because it feels so good when I've worked hard for something and I'm able to look back on it and be proud of my results. I think that's basically the same for everyone, is that when you've gone through something that you know you had to put effort into and you look back, and even if it's not the exact thing that you were looking for, being able to know that you accomplished something just is the best feeling.
Have you been faced with a situation where you had a difficult time convincing someone to change what they were doing so that they could become better? And how did you handle that?
Yeah, all the time. And I guess that's what's great about it, you know, having those challenges, is that there are some people that are quite easy and they're really coachable. You tell them something and they go and change it. And it's quite remarkable how quickly, you know, they can progress. And there's other people that, for whatever reason, they're so holding on to something, you know, some sort of belief or some sort of feeling about themselves that they may not want to change that. And again, I think it comes down to the hard facts, you know, presenting the evidence, putting it in front of them, and then asking them, you know, do you want to move forward? And this is what I know, you know, like being really confident in myself and my knowledge and that being okay. You know, if someone wants to challenge you, that's fine. Go ahead. Challenge me. Because at this point, you know, I have the experience and knowledge to feel pretty confident in what I know. And I'll give you what I know and you can go ahead and take it or you can leave it. But in the end, I think you have to give people what you know and stand back and let them make their own decisions.
Do you think fear or fear of failure often plays a lot into that for them?
Your relationship with trust is really important with whoever you are doing a sport with or trying to increase a skill with. If you don't take time to establish that, then fear will probably still play a huge factor. But if you can create a relationship with someone where they trust you, then they're going to allow you to pull them forward little by little, knowing that you've created a safe space for them. And that can be physically or that can be emotionally.
Tell us about a situation that really tested your coaching skills and how you handled that.
You know, honestly, every time I take out a level four training group, or if I'm leading a level four group for a CSAA course, which is a multi-day course, I feel like I'm testing myself every time. You know, the people that I'm skiing with on those courses or those days are generally quite good skiers and have a lot of experience. So they have a lot of opinion already about skiing. So there's a few things I do to prepare myself to ski with those groups. One is just physical, making sure that I keep myself in shape so that that doesn't become an obstacle, whether it's the terrain or the fitness level of the people in our group or the conditions of that day. Being able to just be fit to sail through that part is really important. Other parts are, you know, mentally just being on the top of my game, making sure that I'm current with the information and the knowledge that I need to be able to just show up and deliver my best on those days. That's really important. And the other part of the mental game is, for me, is just being able to relax so that I can show up. So a lot of times I will, this sounds really corny, but I'm my way up on the hill, I'll listen to Oprah's Super Soul sessions. And because she interviews some really great people that have some really great insight into life and just perspective on life. So being able to grasp an inspiration or a quote or a thought from something like that, that I can then take to the group and start the day saying like, okay, here we are. This is the day. Here's my thought. What do you think? It just creates this common feeling or goal of the day where everyone can relax. I can relax and know that then I can just show up and do my thing.
Now, I think there are a lot of instructors and coaches and even guides in exam situations that find the situation that you just outlined to be quite difficult and stressful. I think that any time we have to perform in front of our peers, especially if they have similar or greater skill sets than us, we can really end up feeling like we were under the microscope. When we are in these situations, I think it's quite common to feel like each of our actions and words are being judged and dissected. What is your advice to people who might find themselves in this situation?
Yeah, I experienced that this year, actually. At the beginning of the year, I conducted course conductor training. So that's when all the course conductors from the country get together and they go over the content for that year. You know, what is the message? Where are we going in this year? And one of the groups that I had that I was leading had a lot of my mentors in the group as participants. So that can be pretty intimidating, you know, going up to that day. And knowing that in our industry, we're pretty judgy. So the opportunity for failure was quite large there and would impact my reputation. So a few things. One for me is to take space and time, again, to know my stuff. If I go in feeling unprepared, I will get nervous and I won't deliver my best. So I take that time to read over the material, make sure that I'm current, make sure I can have good conversations with these people. In order to prepare too, I make cue cards. You can stop me basically in any course on the Hill. If you see me in my CSAA jacket, ask to see my pockets and you will see cue cards that are written in different colors and highlighted with my content for the day. So I don't forget the major nuggets or the plan of the day. That makes me feel more relaxed and confident that I know, you know, I've like put my little rocks down to follow during that day. And the third part, I think, is to not underestimate the value of the people that you have in your group and don't treat them like they don't know anything. You know, use them as much as you can. Ask their opinion. Use the job instead of a maybe leader or presenter of that day to be a facilitator of the group. If you can facilitate discussion and ask people what they know and then guide them along the path, but use them as your major players, everyone seems to have a really good day.
So Tracy, I once had a program manager for an adventure guide training program tell me that one of the students that made him nervous, or the types of students that made him nervous, is when he saw a highly skilled, young, athletic male enter the training program with the goal of becoming a guide. And the reason that this made him nervous was that he knew from experience that when things come easy to someone, it can be really hard for them to relate to how difficult someone else with less natural ability might find that same task. This can lead to a frustration and can negatively affect their ability to get the best out of the people that they're working with. What kind of advice can you give to the listeners out there that may have found themselves in that situation?
Yep. I think you are hitting on something that is probably one of the most important things that I value in a coach, and that's the ability to have empathy. You have to be able to put yourself in your other person's shoes, just see what they're seeing, feel what they're feeling, so that you can coach them appropriately for them. A good example, a lesson that I learned in empathy, which has stuck with me forever, was when I was in grade 3. We had someone come into our classroom and give us these goggles to wear that made everything really blurry. And they explained to us that that's what it looks like for someone that has partial blindness, that's living with partial blindness. And for me, it just struck a huge chord. Like right away, I could see the immediate impact of what someone else would deal with from day to day. So I think it's really important, you know, if you have someone like that come into your group to, one, you can just have a conversation about that. You know, what do you think this would feel like for someone, you know, that is like this or someone that is like this, and have people discuss, you know, what that would be like so that they can think about that. We're trying to put that into our courses for sure. We have a module that I helped write actually for the CSIA, which is called the Learner Considerations Module. And that's exactly what that is about, is try to have empathy for others, you know, other sorts of psychological approaches to skiing. Are you someone that just likes to go, you know, like Jordy, you were talking about that, like kind of just jumping in and trying the car and driving? Or are you someone that likes to sit back and have more of a plan before you go? And being able to know that there's a very likely those different types of learners that are showing up to you, and that your approach maybe have to be different for different people, and finding out what that is key to you being a good coach. If you only take one approach, yeah, you're going to lose people. The engagement is going to go, and you're only going to engage some people that may be like you. So being able to change your approach for different people is really important.
You have a lot of experience, Tracy, in not just instructing, but instructing instructors, which is quite amazing. What does an effective teaching process look like to you?
Yeah, I think that really differs depending on who the student is that you have. So for beginners, I really like to take an approach that's more of a progression approach. So you start from the very basics and just orienting someone to their environment to start. And what you would do is add little block on top of little block as that student progresses. And again, watching to see that it's not too much, maybe having to step back a step before moving forward again. So that works really well with beginners. With more developed students, I use more of a whole part whole approach. So when I was talking about those level four skiers, and we go up in the morning, we get warmed up, and we're skiing basically final form to start. And as a coach, what I'll do is watch that skier and see like what are their components that maybe are missing. And so I'll take one of the components out and work that component again and again in a variety of situations. And that's where exercises and drills come in to really work that one component. Then put that component back into their skiing and then watch the final form again to see if we've had improvement there. So again, it just really depends on the person that you have. And it may be the day, it may be their psychological state that day of what approach you use. And again, watching your students to see what they need.
I remember a ad for the Lake Louise Ski School that was on the way walking up to the lodge there. And I'm not sure if it's there anymore, but it said it was an advertisement for the ski school specifically. And it said, saving relationships since 1972. And basically having someone else instruct your spouse or kids or that sort of thing, right, is people that are close to you can often be the best way to have them feel fulfilled and accomplishments and less frustration. So what's some advice you can give someone who's struggling with teaching their spouse or children?
Yeah, that's funny. I don't know if we actually put that sign up, but we did have a sign in mind anyway that said, snow school, cheaper than divorce. And it's, you know, it's sad, but it's true. You see those couples on the hill and you just see one of the partners just being so deflated, you know, like absolutely emotionally spent on the hill, feeling like a total failure. And the other one, you know, trying really hard to just be like, yeah, you just, come on, just put your skis together, just do this. So I don't know. There are some people that are able to do it. You know, there are some couples that do learn from each other and they've got a great relationship and they can learn from each other. And that is not myself and my husband. Love him, but there's only a couple things that we can do together that, you know, he's great when it comes to climbing. I can totally learn climbing from him. But funny, he was trying to teach me how to telemark ski, and we had made it probably 200 meters before we were in a fight. And I was screaming at him, student-centered teaching. And really what I wanted him to just know was the way that I wanted to learn, which obviously he didn't really know, and he was trying his best. But I guess what's really important in any coaching relationship is that the learner is going to be the learner, and you don't really know how you're going to act emotionally. So the teacher needs to be aware of that and have so much patience and so much time and willingness to step back and give a ton of positive encouragement. They're not going to believe you anyway, your partner, but, you know, being able to encourage a lot and really step back and figure out what is the learner's goals and what is the learner's motivation. And if you can work with those two things, then you're probably going to have a, you know, a great success. If you try to impose your motivation or your goals on your learner, good luck. You know, you see that with kids and with spouses all the time, is that it's more for the teacher than it is for the student. So again, being able to step back and figure that out, that's pretty crucial.
And the reason why there are guides, instructors, coaches is because that's what they do. They're good at it. And they often, even if they know the people already, there's often that sort of professional relationship that's set up, where one is the student and one is the coach or instructor, and it's already kind of set up that way. And if you're coming into it from, you know, being peers, spouses, you know, a parent for, you know, child kind of relationship, you already have these preconceived notions and you're almost set up to for failure in a lot of ways for how it's going to go, because now you're trying to move into that coaching role or student role, and it's just not natural. And, you know, all it takes is an eye roll or a head shake or something like that, and off you go. It's failing right there.
I think you hit it right on the head there. That's exactly.
Yeah. Do you have any gear that you can recommend to our listeners? You spend a lot of time outdoors and in the elements and trying to be professional and take care of yourself. And we often take for granted that people understand how to do that. Give us some tips.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really excited, actually. I've just switched companies over to Blizzard Technica for this given year. I'm really excited for a couple of reasons. One, you know, their high-end stuff is fantastic. I just did an inner ski training course for a couple days, and man, was it so fun being on my new skis and boots. Makes me really excited. The thing that's really cool also about this company is that they have a women to women program. So they are trying really hard to, you know, develop and support women skiers, and that's through their education and inspiration, the product and the community that they're trying to develop. One thing that's great that I really noticed about this community is that there are a lot of skis for women. So they're not just low-end skis. You know, if you're a high-performing female, you're still going to find really great on-piste skis, kind of mid-mountain skis, so on-piste, off-piste, and, you know, backcountry stuff as well. So really great lines for all skiers, but especially women skiers, and that really makes me excited. So we're finally catering to the other half of the population that may like to ski.
Do you find that female skiers might actually be more discerning in trying to find what they like, as opposed to possibly male? You know, I might be generalizing here, but I find for myself, like, somebody gives me a pair of skis when I get to a heli ski company, and I just kind of slide around on them and put up with them and whatever. But I have found that females are often more thoughtful in their gear selection process, as a generalism.
That is really interesting, because I haven't thought about that. But yes, I have a lot of, I guess that's why it's popular, you know, why women want to consult with me. They want to know a lot of the information about what they're about to get on. And they usually want to demo something before they buy it. And it may be a few different pairs of skis, which is good. And that's what you should do. You should find gear that makes you happy and fits for you, because we really are built differently. We have different weights. We have different aggression styles, whether you're quite aggressive or you're not so much. We all prefer either on-piste or maybe some bumpy stuff, or, you know, big fat lines. So really finding the gear that fits you is really important, because it affects your whole experience. You know, that's with boots and with skis. So yeah, I do find, you know, women like to have someone to talk to and try some stuff out with. It's been cool. We've done a couple online. I'm also part of a Women in Skiing committee with the CSIA. And so every year we usually have a gear talk. So Leslie Baker Brown, who's part of the Blizzard Technica Women to Women program, she's come and spoke with us for the last couple of years about gear, you know, showing different types of skis, showing different type of boots, what you should look for, you know, how you should be treated when you go into a store, that you're not just a girl who doesn't know anything. You know yourself, and that's really all you need to know, is what something feels like for you. So she's been an amazing promoter, you know, of that program and getting to know your gear. And I actually wish there were more opportunities for women and people in general just to try stuff before they buy it, so that they're, because it's not cheap, right, to set yourself out with some ski gear. So yeah, so if you need information, you know, reach out, we'll help you out.
And this speaks to that whole coaching side of things, which is trust, right? And so if you can speak to somebody who you trust to advise you on the equipment, then it kind of progresses all the way through to where you're actually doing the activity.
That's really important, because it's not just what you're on. I don't need to recommend something that I'm skiing on if that person is not the same skier as I am. My job as a coach is to know what type of skiing they're going to do, what type of person they are when they're on the slope, so that you can recommend the right gear for them. It's like going into a store. The same, some women were talking about this the other day when I went into a clothing store, and the salesperson was like, I will never sell something or tell someone that it looks good on them if it doesn't. And that's what you need. You need someone to be really truthful, be saying like, this is the fit for you. And if I don't have this for you at this time, let's find someone that can fit you with something. Because again, it's really important. It impacts your whole experience.
Well, thanks so much for your time, Tracy.
Yeah, that was really fun. I honestly love geeking out and talking about skiing and development and growth. It's my jam.
I don't think we do that enough in the various industries that we're involved with. And so I think this is going to be really valuable for our listeners to have this as a resource that, you know, it exists places, right? We do professional development and we focus on our instructional skills and our guiding skills. But yeah, you can never do enough of that in your never ending quest to be a better coach, instructor, guide.
Yeah. And you know what, if I could do a little plug for the CSAA, like if you are a ski geek out there and you do like listening to this stuff and talking about it, and you want to find, you know, a group of like-minded people, the CSAA courses are great, because that's what you do. You find your people and you hang out and you geek out and talk about skiing and development of skiing and teaching approaches. And it's great for your own skiing, you know, as one part of it, but it's really great for you just to become a better skier and a coach.
We're going to let you go here, Tracy. Thank you so much for coming on. This has been fantastic. Okay, Jordy, when it comes to being an effective coach, what were some of your takeaways or things that jumped out at you from what Tracy had to say?
Well, Chris, yeah, there's so many good points there and tips and tricks from Tracy. She's obviously very, very experienced in the progression of bringing people up through what she does in terms of skiing. And, you know, one thing that stood out was observing and looking for areas that can be improved. A good coach is someone who can watch and listen to people carefully. And what a good coach is looking for are the weaknesses in the people that they are coaching, and the weaknesses in particular that they can help with. One of the best ways to manage the risks that that we face is to make sure that we are as good as we can be. The better we are at anything, the less likely we are to make a mistake. So being better also makes everything more enjoyable, right? If we can help people bring up their level of skill set to a point where they are consciously competent, then it's just more enjoyable. They know what they're doing, and then they can just focus on the experience. Another one that stood out for me is the pace of delivery of information. So people really can get frustrated if we give them way too many things to work on or to think about at one time. And I've been guilty of that too in my training and coaching side of things. This can cause them to struggle with, with achieving results, and in the end, make them even more frustrated. So being an effective coach requires that we ensure that we pace the amount of information and the amount of feedback and the amount of tips and ideas that we give them. You're standing there on the snow slope and you say, try these 7 different things or even 2 different things. And really, that doesn't work for me. So why would it work for them? So one thing at a time and in order of priority, hopefully too. So you can work on one skill set, one thing to fix, and then, okay, yeah, that's much better. And then maybe even give it a bit of time where it's like, okay, we're just focusing still on that. And you know there's all these other things to work on, but they don't know that yet. And then you carry on giving them another one. And another thing that is really helpful is we have in our pocket all the time Super Pro 4K video cameras. It's called our phone.
And so don't be afraid to pull that out and just snap a few, you know, photos or even better video, and then show it to them. So one of the keys to being an effective coach is to ensure that we pace the amount of feedback and material that we're giving people. Really, if you try and push them too far, too fast, you end up overwhelming them. And this can be a real challenge for coaches who love to share what they know. So just, you know, trickle the information out and you probably will see better results faster.
That's an excellent point, Jordy. You know, often I think of presenting information when we're teaching. That's really what we're doing. I think of it as doing it in a way that is like telling a story. And if we look at how a book is structured, you know, the first chapter gives you a little bit of information, then every chapter that comes afterwards adds on to it. So like you said there, I like how you phrased that, of giving the most relevant information first and then going from there. A couple of the key takeaways for me and what she had to say was, first, the idea of being student-centered, or taking that student-specific approach. And so each person that we deal with is unique. Everybody thinks and reacts and learns in a different way. And so one approach may work for one person, whereas it might not work for another person. And so, you know, when we're teaching people skills or trying to improve them, we really need to be open to trying different methods. And if one thing doesn't work, then we may have to switch gears. Just because we want to tell a story a certain way doesn't mean that that's going to resonate with our audience. The second part I'll just touch on is the idea of getting that buy-in to change behavior patterns. You can't change someone's performance if they don't see a problem with what they're doing to start with. And so if you want somebody to get better, and the reason you might need them to get better is to make it safer for them or more enjoyable, or to increase their efficiency so that they can go farther and they don't get tired, you're going to have to make the case as to why they should want to do that in the first place. Now let's turn it over to you, the listener. What were your key takeaways? You can share your thoughts, stories, and insights with us via our social media feeds or by emailing us. You can find all of our contact information at deliveringadventure.com and in the show notes. Please don't forget to click the follow or subscribe button for this podcast in your favorite player so that you don't miss out on future episodes. Also, if you enjoyed the show, please consider sharing it with your like-minded friends so that they can enjoy it too. Thanks for listening.